Philippa Langley, MBE, or King Finder, as her children called her when she returned from Leicester in 2012, having discovered the bones of Richard III in a car park there, is a world-renowned writer, producer, and Ricardian. Without her exhaustive and painstaking research, the Looking for Richard project would never have happened. Her role in it was subsequently portrayed in the 2022 film The Lost King, starring Steve Coogan and Sally Hawkins as Philippa. Her new book, The Princes in the Tower, sees her rewrite history again, as she shares evidence to suggest the princes in the tower were not killed by Richard III, as has been the widespread belief. Throughout her work, she's encountered skepticism and dismissal, but she's always found a way to keep going, all the while battling chronic ME.
That was a real sliding doors moment in my life. I didn't recognise it at the time. I just felt, you know, that my world was imploding.
What takes you from a place of just being intrigued by a person to being now a world-renowned historian?
There was a lot that I had to put up with, a lot of scepticism, a lot of ridicule, a lot of personal denigration. But I think if you let something like that get to you, you're never going to achieve what you want to achieve. And I had to actually sit down, because I just thought, it doesn't make sense.
Philippa, I'm sort of fascinated to know how you would describe yourself, how you think of yourself, because this is called Performance People, this podcast, and we're usually speaking to sports people or people in the world of business, people perhaps from the world of finance or entertainment, say. But you epitomize a performance person, in my opinion. You think about what it's taken to get you to where you are today and the things that you've done. I feel like determination, rigor, grit, facing adversity and overcoming it, all the things that you associate with performance are sort of you in one person. And ultimately, performance is all about results, which is, again, something that you can clearly identify with. How do you see yourself?
I think you've covered it a lot in what you said, and that determination. I think I've always had that. And I think my father recognized that, and he always drilled into me, you never give in, you never give up. If there's something you want to do, if there's something, you know, that laser focus that you've got, then you don't give in and you don't give up. I don't know if that's a Northern English thing, but certainly for me, with my Northern English father, that was very much what he drilled into my psyche as a child. And I think that's, I've carried that with me the whole time.
And yet the discovery of Richard III, for which you're probably best known, is not something that you were always on the path to discover. I mean, an illness, a personal illness, led you to discover and read more about this king and want to know more, and effectively has changed the outcome of his story and your own. Tell us a little bit about that and how even that happened.
Yeah, that was a real sliding doors moment in my life. I didn't recognize it at the time. I just felt, you know, that my world was imploding, because I was very physically active, very physically able. I'd been a feral child. Sport had been my thing my entire life. So even when I started work, I was at the gym, and this is going to give you some idea of the era that I'm from, but I would be doing aerobics, I'd be doing step classes, I'd be doing strength training, all the while that I had my career going on. But you're right, I was going for my dream job. I was really excited to get this dream job, and I fell ill, and I fell seriously ill. I got Beijing flu, I was wiped out, and I got chronic fatigue from it. So I lost my job. And I lost that relationship that I could have with being physical and enjoying sport and enjoying that activity. And it all just went. So at the time, it really was like the worst thing that ever happened to me. But now, looking back, if I hadn't have had that sliding doors moment, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing now. I'd be in my dream job and certainly wouldn't have taken this road. So was it meant to be? I don't know.
So what was that like? Just take us back. Like you say, you're on a particular trajectory And then your whole world suddenly, as you say, implodes because of this illness. And how long were you set back for? And what led you to sort of delve deeper into Richard III and his story? Because obviously you're in this situation where you can't be physically active. But how long did that period of time take, and your road to recovery, and then the thing that kept you on this story? You didn't let it go. You kept pursuing it.
I think it literally was by necessity, because I couldn't, I was so ill. All that was left for me to do was to read. That's the only thing I could do that didn't totally, totally exhaust me. And so that's when I started reading everything I could about this man, because just before I'd fallen ill, I'd gone on holiday and read a book about him. And I thought I was reading, you know, going to be reading about the Shakespearean villain, if you like, the psychopath. But actually, I read this book by an American academic who used the contemporary source materials from Richard's lifetime and spoke about this completely different kind of guy. So this really intrigued me, because I thought, why do we always speak about this man in terms of the dramatic narrative of his lifetime and not the actual historical materials and evidences from his lifetime? So it was reading, and I just read everything that I could, because I could keep my brain going. I couldn't be physically active anymore, but I could keep my brain going. And this was before the internet. So it was about buying books, reading books. And then I joined the Richard III Society in, I think it was about 1998 when I joined them. And that was a step up, because suddenly I was able to get hold of their archive and read all of these research papers. And that was a big turning moment. That was, because suddenly there was so much more information available to me. So it was slow, and I had to learn how to manage the illness bit by bit.
I mean, what that shows is incredible patience and tenacity. But what takes you from a place of just being intrigued by a person to being now a world-renowned historian on that very person, and having actually located the site where subsequently his bones were brought up to the surface, and the rest, as they say now, is history? I mean, what was that journey like? Because it's one thing to go from, you know, reading and being fascinated by a person, it's quite another to lead you to the place where you ended up.
It was a sense of, it was important, because I think for me, truth is important. And there were all these stories wrapped around Richard, but also wrapped around his burial, you know, that he was so evil that he'd been dug up and his remains had been thrown into the river. There was no evidence for that story. It was just a story that was tagged onto him in, I think, about the 17th century. So it felt that it was an important thing to do, to try and find his grave, but also to give him a tomb monument, to give him a burial location, and to try and get more knowledge about the actual historical individual out there by doing that. So I think there was a determination for sure, but there was a laser focus on that at the time. And I think I'm just the kind of person that once I put the blinkers on and once I decide to do something, then the more people that say no, then I just walk around them and try and find doors that will open. And it's just not accepting no, really. It's about being really bloody minded, I think, at the end of the day.
It is extraordinary, though, because, like you say, you did have to face huge, I mean, bearing in mind you're dealing with evidence being the primary thing here and the most important thing here, and the truth being told the way it should be told, and him being remembered the way that history should remember him. It's interesting, because you were met with such skepticism, weren't you? I mean, you mentioned about the people that you had to sort of get around in order to get this done. I mean, how problematic was that? And what did that take from you, trying to overcome that adversity? Because it must have been exhausting.
It was exhausting. But, you know, I'm a child of the 60s and 70s, and you know, when you get patronized or denigrated, you form ways to deal with it. And so you either ignore it, or you smile, or you laugh, or you just, you know, you move on. You don't do the head-on collision with it that probably, you know, young girls would do now, but you didn't then. And so that's kind of what I did. I just had to ignore it because I had to. It wasn't about me. It wasn't about my ego. It wasn't about narcissism. It was about getting a job done. And so I just had to take on board whatever was coming my way in order to get to the end goal. That's all that I had in my mind. And the end goal was getting the tarmac cut to go and search for Richard. Once the tarmac was being cut, then, you know, I was there, job done. And so, yeah, there was a lot that I had to put up with, a lot of skepticism, a lot of ridicule, a lot of personal denigration. But I think if you let something like that get to you, you're never going to achieve what you want to achieve. And you just have to sidestep it. It just has to be something that is not important to you. And you've just got to get around it.
What was really
And again, I think it's about energy as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was just saying, if you spend your energy trying to deal with it, for me, I wouldn't have any energy left for what I wanted to do. So I had to save what energy I had as well.
And I suppose you learned that as a result of your illness, right? You probably learned how to channel your energy in the right way.
Yeah, it's like being a human battery, and I have to sleep bank in order to complete that battery, fill that battery. And then you reach a point where you know you're getting down in terms of your energy levels. So you have to then conserve it. I couldn't tell. Only friends and friends and family knew that I had chronic fatigue. I couldn't tell anybody about it because there was judgments around it then. And it's one of these physical conditions that at that time, people did make these judgments, and you were seen as like a shirker or somebody who's got something wrong mentally, that sort of thing. I mean, sadly, with long COVID, that's not the case anymore. But at that point, yes. So nobody knew I had it, and I had to present as not being ill the whole time.
Wow.
Which is another stress.
Yeah, and there must have been huge moments, because you had these various different key moments over the course of that sort of 7.5-8 year period where, like you say, the stress of one minute you've got the funding for the project, the next minute you don't, and having to go and find the funding again for the project. I mean, there must have been huge moments which potentially could have been triggers.
Yeah, absolutely there was. And stress is definitely a trigger. Getting cold is another trigger. And I nearly did give up. There was one point when I'd lost all the funding initially for the dig, and I just thought, I can't do this anymore. I really can't do it. And it was actually my partner, John, who was the one who said to me, he said, look, you've done 99% of the work. You can't give up now. And I thought, he's right. I've got to give it one more go. And that one more go, we got there. So, yeah.
They're hugely emotional scenes in a variety of different things I've watched with you in them, which depict obviously the moment where the bones were found, whether it be the documentary that you made, which was filming at the time of the discovery, which is remarkable and was able to capture that as it happened, whether it be the film and how you've spoken about it subsequently. It must have been the most emotionally bizarre moment when the tarmac was cut in exactly the right place, where R was placed for the reserved parking in that social services car park in Leicester. I mean, what were the feelings inside you? How did they manifest at that moment in time? It must have been this huge relief, but at the same time, great responsibility with what was happening.
Yeah, it was a real mixture of emotions. And again, it was hugely stressful because a lot of the people who were involved with the dig and the search for Richard really just thought it was a complete wild goose chase. And, you know, looking for the church was good, that was worthwhile, but forget it in terms of Richard III. So And then the first thing we find on, you know, within a few hours of the dig is we find the lower leg bones in the exact place where I thought the king would be, where my research confirmed that the church likely was and the choir. And, you know, again, they sort of, and I understood it, you know, the archaeologist said, look, it's the first find. We don't know where we are yet. We don't even know if we're in the Greyfriars area. We just have to cover them up and carry on. I understood that. But by the time we got to the halfway point of the dig, and we now knew that this was the possible location of the church. And although they said, look, it's that's the nave, it's too far west. That's not the, you know, where these remains are. That's not the choir. And I disagreed. But luckily, as the client, I could instruct exhumation of those remains and then pay for them because I had a bit of money left. So again, it was it was that laser focus. And that was my hot area, my key area. So I thought, I'm going to spend the last bit of money that I have left in getting these remains examined and exhumed. And they were those of the king.
And how did you feel? You're standing there in this social services car park 7.5 years after this research has started, with various ups and downs along the way and the possibilities of this never unfolding in the way that you hope it might. And yet there it is. It's there. The king is there. I mean, how on earth did that make you feel in that moment when you're standing on top of that tarmac and peering into that trench and seeing what you're seeing?
It was overwhelming, but probably not for the reason that you think it was overwhelming, because I'd kind of braced myself that there was the possibility we could find Richard. But what was utterly overwhelming was that when he was uncovered, they, you know, the specialist there said that he looks, this is a hunchback, because they could see there was the curve in the spine. And of course, all of the research I'd done on Richard, there was no descriptions of him from his lifetime by people who met him that suggested there was anything abnormal about him. And I think once we discovered that the grave had been cut too short, so he didn't have kyphosis, which is a forward bend of the spine, but he had a scoliosis, then it kind of made sense, because you'll know people with scoliosis, it's a physical condition. It's not a disability. Usain Bolt has scoliosis. So then sort of it began to make sense, because when Richard had died, there was a comment that somebody said he had one shoulder higher than the other. But I think at the time when he was being uncovered and they said this is a hunchback, again, it was Shakespeare looms so large with Richard III that I thought we're never going to get past this. How is he, you know, there's a hunchback, horrendous word to use, but if he has kyphosis, he couldn't have fought in battle. He couldn't have done all of the things that we actually knew he did. So it didn't make any sense to me. And I think that's why I think when you look at the documentary, and I had to actually sit down, because I just thought, it doesn't make sense. So it was overwhelming, utterly overwhelming.
And then subsequently, of course, your role in it, how important was it for you, because you're approached by Steve Coogan to tell the story your way, how important was it for you? Your history is as a screenwriter as well. You talk about the fact that you'd sit down to do that initially, and this had led you to obviously discover more about Richard. What was it about that opportunity that you thought, we have to do this, we have to tell this way?
Yeah, I must admit, when I met Steve for the first time, in my head, I'm thinking, well, you know, I'll meet him and that will be that, and I'll have done that and that's fine, but it's not going to happen. Because, you know, he's the comedic genius. So I thought, you know, he's just going to be larking about. It's just going to be a big laugh to him. It's going to be a big joke. That's what I thought I was going to get. But when I met him, he's very, very different person in real life. He's incredibly serious. And the amount of research that he'd done into the search for Richard, the questioning that he did with me, And I realized that he's really serious about this, but he really knows, because he was asking questions about, they say this, but how does that work? And he was really drilling down into the real story behind the scenes. So I began to tell him a little bit. And so he was then getting a sense of the real story. And he just said to me, he just said, you know, look, Philippa, I like to tell the story of little people who don't have a voice and who don't get to tell their story. Because at this point, you know, it was the University of Leicester who had found Richard III. They had led the search for Richard III. That was the story that was everywhere. And so he said, I want to tell your story. I want to give you a voice. And I thought, okay, I'm going to trust him and I'm going to give him everything. And then it's up to him for what he does with it.
There's a certain irony, isn't there, in the fact that you're trying to tell Richard's truth and yet your own truth is being written a different way. I think there's a sort of sense of irony in that, and therefore you felt the need to, you know, right that wrong and address that balance.
Yes. I think, again, you don't really see it until you look back. But there has been quite a bit of irony on that. And I think still, even today, you know, I get denigrated, you know, by people saying, oh, she's just an emotional idiot who's in love with Richard III. And you just think, really? Seriously? But again, that's why I'm not on social media, because I can't be bothered with it.
Good idea. Has it changed you as a person, though, the process and the discovery? It must have done, the discovery of Richard III and how you've approached everything that's come subsequently. You've now got this Prince's project as well, and there are other things. So is it something that you've, what's the biggest lesson, I guess, that you've learned from that process that you've been able to apply subsequently?
I think there's two things that I've learned. I think number one is trust has to be earned. I would give people my trust because they had a powerful name, like they were a professor or a doctor or whatever they were. So I don't do that anymore. And I think probably since hashtag Me Too, I now call people out on things straight away. Someone says something to me, I'm like, sorry, what? I don't just smile. I don't ignore it. I don't just let it go. So I think that's probably where I've changed. I'm a bit more ballsy, openly ballsy about things now. Yeah.
And with regards to taking things further, the Prince's Project, where is that at currently? Because obviously the book's out and we've seen the documentary, and it's fascinating because lightning, as they say, doesn't always strike twice, but it feels like it is with you. You've rewritten history once. Is it happening all over again?
Yeah, it is. And it's really exciting at the moment because the book is now out. The documentary is great, but we were meant to have 2 hours for the documentary, but we got a quarter of an hour sliced off. And you can just imagine how much information we lost in that quarter of an hour. But the book contains the totality of evidences that we've now uncovered. And so we now know that the princes survived and they went on to fight for the throne against Henry VII. So, yeah, it's really exciting. The project is running live as we speak. We're still going and we are finding more things. So there's going to be more announcements to come. So we'll wait and see with that. We don't know what we're going to do with them, whether there's another documentary or whether I just add some more chapters to the book. But it's really exciting, really exciting.
And it must have felt like the most natural progression to take your work from Richard III into the Prince's Project. Was the Prince's Project always something that you'd been fascinated by, or did it end up becoming that way because of the work on Richard III?
Yeah, I was at the reburial for Richard in March 2015, and it was going to be job done, that I'd done what I set out to do and go home, put my feet up, you know, start another part of my life. But what happened there was this one-page article in the Daily Mail newspaper during the reburial week, and it ran with a headline of, "It's mad to make this child killer a national hero." And then it cited that he was a murderer of children, and it gave all the story of how Richard murdered the princes in the tower. But again, there was no evidence. So like Richard being thrown into the River Soar story, it was a later story that had no evidence. So as I was literally getting on the train to go home after we'd reburied Richard III, I already had the Missing Princes Project in my mind and thinking I have to start another evidence-based project because this is a huge question. You know, we'll never get to know who the historic Richard III is unless we really do the forensic deep dive into this question finally once and for all. So it's not opinion. It's looking for evidence. And that was the big difference.
Can I ask you where you start on a project? And if you have people who apply themselves to projects normally have timelines in mind, deadlines in mind. They're thinking of, you know, points along that process where you'll sit and then assess what you've got and go in one direction or the other, depending on the results of the findings. How does it work when you're doing what you do as work? How do you apply yourself in that way? How do you start it? And then how do you measure success along the way?
I think with the search for Richard, once I'd got past that first not giving up, then it was all stations go. And it actually took from the beginning to the end, it was 10 years. So it was a long time for him to, you know, to get to the reburial. So it's 2005 to 2015. And I think when I started the Missing Princes Project, when I first started looking into what we knew about this story, I think it was so overwhelming, the amount of stories that I had to look into, potential red herrings that I had to look into, potential lines of investigation, that I said to myself, okay, I've probably got to give this 10 years as well in order to this have some hope of success. So that's where I'm at. I am going to give it 10 years. So we're now, it was formally launched in 2016. So I'm going to give it to 2026. But at the rate we're going, I think we may be done before 2026.
I was going to say, when you
but
say
I'll
we're going
to
give
then
it.
If need to.
Yeah. But what are you ultimately looking for? Because you've already, as you say, got evidence to show that the two princes weren't murdered by Richard. They did survive and subsequently launched invasions. What are you looking for? What's the end game with the princes?
I think it's just to see what we can find. You know, we've found so much already. And it's just a case of there's so many lines of investigation that are still open. So, you know, once I published the book and did the documentary, there was a moment where I thought, okay, do I just close the lines and wind up? But then I thought, no. I thought, let's see where all this takes us. And I'm pleased I did, because literally about 2 or 3 days ago, I had something come in, which is really exciting. So I think I'll definitely give it more time.
You realize you cannot leave it like that. 2 or 3 days ago, we had something really exciting come in. Da 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 da.
Yeah, yeah. I have to, because obviously everything has to be checked. Everything has to be double, triple checked. So, yeah.
So obviously I associate you with huge success, but what happens when it doesn't pan out the way that you expect it's going to pan out? Have you had moments where that's obviously happened?
Absolutely. And when I began the Missing Princes Project, I had to take that on board, because the story was so powerful about Richard murdering the princes that I thought, okay, that can be the story. That maybe is what happened. And so I had to come to terms with that, because it was about finding the truth, whatever the truth was. And I had to contact, you know, a number of people at the Richard III Society and say, look, I'm going to do this project. I don't know what we're going to find. And they were great. They all said, look, we're a research organization. This is what we do. Whatever you find is going to move our knowledge forward. So that kind of gave me the freedom to then go ahead and to just think, okay, whatever is out there, we're going to find, we're going to look, we're going to search.
And the thing that's really special that's depicted in, you know, every account of finding Richard III and also in this Prince's Project is there's a team around you. You're all galvanized. Your team is galvanized, isn't it, to discover the truth. How important, I mean, in sport and in performance, we always talk about the importance of teamwork for obvious reasons. But how much does it matter in the line of work you're in as well? Because it can be the truth you want to tell, but how important is it to pull together a crack team that can help you do that?
It's really important because I can't, there's no way on God's green earth could I do all of this myself. I had to ask for, you know, volunteers to join me if they were interested in searching their local archives and that sort of thing, being the boots on the ground, being an army, if you like, a research army. And I've been really lucky, I think, and blessed with the people who've been in touch with me because it's the full spectrum. You know, I've got ordinary people who just want to walk into their archive and speak to the archivist and see what they can find. But I've got medieval historians, I've got police, magistrates, advocates, and also specialists like in osteology and medieval writing and paleography and Latin, all that sort of thing, and ancient languages like Old French. So it's been huge because I've got so many specialists that I can call on to help, and they give their time freely. Some of them have to charge for the work for sure, but most of them give their time freely. And I don't think there's any way a project like this could have been done. I think without the internet, it just was, it's too huge. It was too big because I've got over 300 members around the world. And currently on the supercomputer that I have here at home, I've got over 300,000 files, which I have to be able to check, double check, cross-reference and run searches through. So, yeah, I think a project like this could only have been done now with the connectivity that we have.
Amazing. See, these things are often down, aren't they, to a little bit of timing, a little bit of, you know, the world in which you're living in at the moment. It's sort of, it's like the perfect storm for all the right reasons, which is good to hear. Philippa, if I could ask you for it, people who are listening, watching the podcast, they're really fascinated by the idea that somebody like yourself, the life in which you're living, what makes you tick? What do you do every day? Is there something you do every day that focuses? You talk about your laser focus. What do you do to make sure that is in tip-top condition?
Do you know, it's about quiet time, which probably sounds very odd, doesn't it? Considering it sounds like it's a very active thing to be doing in terms of a big research project. But I'm really lucky. I live, I've got an ancient old copse at the back of the house. And so I have to give myself downtime, quiet time, when everything is switched off, phones are off, everything's off. And, you know, if the weather's good, I sit in the garden and I just listen to the wildlife and become very quiet, very still. Or if the weather's bad, I've got a big window and I can sit in front of that window and watch the old oak copse. And that's when I ground myself. And it's in those moments, funnily enough, that sometimes a problem that you've had, you know, you think is an insolvable one. How can I get here? What can I do with that? Suddenly it will come. Or you'll wake up in the morning and it's in, you know, when you've had sleep as well. And sleep is really important. Again, with chronic fatigue syndrome, it has to be. But it's the quality of sleep. Mm. So it's the hours of sleep that I get before midnight. Those are the most important hours of sleep for me. So I can go to bed at 9 o'clock at night, you know, which probably sounds like you don't have much of a life, Philippa, but sometimes I have to do it. And I have to sleep bank a lot. And there has been moments when I've slept for 18 hours nonstop, and on one occasion, 24 hours nonstop.
Wow.
Yeah. But I think you just have to listen to your body.
What did that follow? What had happened leading up to that moment that you that you slept for that length of time?
That 24 hours, I can tell you now, that was when I got back from Leicester after we'd found the king. And that got back home and, you know, my sons gave me a great big hug. And I said, look, we found him. You have to keep it secret. I'm sure it's him because of this, that. And they called me King Finder. And I'm so pleased that they put that in the film, which was lovely. But my partner, John, who had his own place then, he knew, he could see how exhausted I was because I get these dark circles under my eyes. And he said, you need to sleep, don't you? And I said, yeah. So he said, come on, boys, I'm going to take you to mine for a couple of days. And again, I just literally went to bed and thought, I'm going to sleep for a while. And I woke up 24 hours later.
That's
exhausted.
Extraordinary.
But, yeah.
Yeah, well deserved, clearly, evidently. Philippa, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you so much. It's been fascinating. You are, to me, you are the ultimate performance person. Thank you so much for coming on our podcast.
Thank you for having me, Georgia. It's been an honour. Thank you.